Okay, Marav Rabosai. What we have to do today doesn't sound like that much, but it's actually a huge amount, which is Simin Shin Lamed Tes. And Simin Shin Lamed Tes exposes us to the two major shilohs that are discussed in our world regarding medical halacha at the end of life. Like, medical halacha really breaks down to two halves. There's medical halacha at the beginning of life, which is what we learned the first three quarters of the year. And we had doctors come in and discuss questions of nida and yoledus, etc. And then there's the question of medical halacha at the end of life. And that question basically boils down to withdrawal of treatment and brain death. Those are the two large issues that come down. But I wanted to do it more from the from the sources, so we'll learn Yeridei Simin Shin Lamed Tes. Shteit in the Mechaber, the Hagoseis Harehu Kechai L'chol Devarav, that a Goseis halachically is considered alive for everything, and therefore you don't tie up his cheeks. After Misa, you tie the jaws so that doesn't open up. You put some oil on the goat, on the mace, in order to make sure that he's cleaned. You rinse him off, poke a in the cover. We have this entire thing, which is what we basically do in the Tahara, but we don't do any of those processes while the fellow is still goseis, until the fellow is actually dead. And the reason why we don't do this is because we don't want the person to give up. We feel, al pi halacha, that chaye sha'a is also significant. Every moment of this world that a person can be osek in ma'isim tovim and in tefilos and do tshuva to Rabbono Shel Olam is yafe mikol chaye olam haba. So therefore, we don't do anything until you're actually dead. You don't close the eyes until should say nafsho. The Maseches Machos adds that anybody who touches a goseis, the Shach quotes this in Sivkat and Hey, if you touch a goseis, you are a shofet domen. It's like when you have a candle that's beginning to flicker near the end. If you touch that candle, you're going to make it go out. So therefore, we don't do anything until you're actually dead. That's the basic halacha. Now, the Ramah adds, based on the Yehuda HaChosev, we don't dig a kever until you're actually dead. There's a little bit of a discussion that we'll talk about what happens, let's say, in a situation when the guy is about to die late on the Friday, and you could get the Levaya in on the Friday if you begin to dig the kever beforehand, because digging a grave could take a while. So the Pashtus in Shulchan Aruch is that we don't do that. It happens that Reb Tzvi Pesach Frank, in his Tshuvas in the Har Tzvi Simen Reish Samach, says that the minig of the Chevra Kaddish in Yerushalayim is that they do dig the grave before the guy dies. And he defends this practice because the whole cheshbon for why you're not supposed to do it is because you don't want the goseis to give up on life. The Shach already quotes in the Bach that it's mutter me'ikar hadin if you're digging a kever somewhere far away. No? The goseis is in the hospital in Shaarei Tzedek and they're going to be digging the grave on Har HaMenuchos. He doesn't know that they're digging a grave for him. Even though the Sefer Chassidim, Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid in the Tzavu'a says that if you do this, the grave is going to end up being used, if not for this guy, for someone else in town, within 16 days the guy's going to die. And therefore you really should not do that. Nonetheless, the Minyan Yerushalayim is that they do it, relying on the Bach, etc. This is what it says in the Tshuva of the Har Tzvi, Simen Reish Samach. So l'maisa, the Chevra Kaddisha will dig a grave, but you should not do anything in the presence of the goseis that speaks about his death. Now you have to be very careful, right? Like we spoke about last time, saying the vidui, right? One of the halachas that's mentioned in Shulchan Aruch is that you can't have Noshim and Ketanim say the vidui, so that they shouldn't cry, etc. You say vidui in a way that, like, maybe b'schus the vidui you'll live. We want to keep this guy alive as much as possible. And one of the hardest things I have as a rabbi is when I'm called to say vidui with somebody, not to cry during Shas Amiris vidui is extremely difficult. It's really very, very hard. But you don't want the guy to die. So you don't talk about levaya arrangements. Sometime the family you come in and the family say, Rabbi, can we discuss the funeral? So you say, no, we can't. We can't discuss the funeral. If you want, discuss the funeral outside in a different room so that the geisus doesn't hear you, kol hakavod, no? But in the present, you don't discuss the funeral, ki hu zeh, because, chas v'shalom, we don't want you to give up, we don't want the geisus to give up on any bit of life. Kevin, you had a question?
Just with our speakers out front, that's only on Friday or any time we could?
The minhag in Yerushalayim is that sometimes they will dig the kever beforehand, in particular on Friday, but even on other times, they will prepare the kever. Sometimes they want to get a day of Shiva in. In Yerushalayim, they will do kavura even at night. No? Other places in the world, again, it's not halachic. That's like gravedigger union stuff. The gravedigger union doesn't let us dig graves at night, but Lameisa, they will do it in Yerushalayim even, right, even on an ordinary Wednesday to get a day of Shiva in. Yeah.
It's not a bath that it's all about whether or not the Gozis is going to like hear about it. If the Gozis is brain dead or...
So we don't know what they hear and what they don't hear. Again, we'll talk about brain death separately. But Lameisa, we don't know. And our tradition is that even though the person does not seem to be responsive, we don't want to talk about anything while the person is present, because heaven forbid we should be mekarev misaso. Nirlefi in the estate, that the poskim over here take the tzavla of Rabbi Yehuda HaChosid more seriously than in other cases. There's two things. Rabbi Yehuda HaChosid lived from 1140 to 1217. He wrote a tzavla, he wrote a will also. Generally speaking, the poskim take the stuff in the Sefer Chassidim more seriously than they take the will. And they assume that the will, the tzavla of Rabbi Yehuda HaChosid, is written only lebnei mishpachto. These shilas do come up occasionally. You get a shilas sometimes, Rebbe, am I allowed to marry a girl who has the same name as my mother? No? You ever got the shila? You will, trust me. You'll get the question, these types of things. So the Noit of Yehuda in the Tshuva and Simen Ayin Tes, it's Noit of Yehuda and Evan HaEzer Simen Ayin Tes, the Noit of Yehuda says that the Tzavla of Rabbi Yehuda HaChosid is only for his family. That's quoted by the Pesukei Tshuva in Evan HaEzer and Simen, like Beis or something, right at the beginning. And the Mice, I think the standard approach of poskim is that we don't really accept the Tzavla of Rabbi Yehuda HaChosid. Rabbi Yehuda HaChosid, for example, says that two brothers are not supposed to marry two sisters, no? Look in the tshuva of the Malabed Lahoel in Chelek Evan HaEzer Simen Yud Zayin, where he tells the story that Rabbi Avram Bing was a Talmud Chasam Sefer, and he had two of his sons married two sisters. And on the way to the second chasana, the horse with the carriage, turned over. And all of the wedding stuff got dirty. So Rabbi Avram Bing, according to the Malamed Lahoy, according to Rabbi Zvi Hoffman, gets up from this and he says, it's a patch from Rabbi Yehuda HaChosid, let's go and get married. Now, one could have interpreted that, oh my gosh, you know, there's like a simen min hashamayim, and we shouldn't get married in this case. Rabbi Avram Bing did not want to do this. He said, no, Rabbi Yehuda HaChosid has given me a patch, let's go and get married. And most posts can feel that what Rabbi Yehuda HaChosid has in the tzava'a is not halachically binding. If you're part of his mishpacha, maybe, no? Do you shave on Erev Rosh Chodesh? Do you shave on Rosh Chodesh? Tomorrow. How many of you guys are going to shave tomorrow? Okay, so I know you're all yeshiva bachurim and you shave once a month or something. But assuming that you're a normal human being who doesn't have a beard, so you shave more often than that, so most poskim feel that unless you're part of the mishpacha of Rabbi Yehuda HaChosid, you shave on Rosh Chodesh, no? That's standard Judaism. So Lameisa, I'm not sure exactly why Rav Hirsch Pesach Frank is so bothered by the Tzavah of Rabbi Yehuda HaChosid. I would just say that we machavek with it. Those things that come from Sefer HaChassid, and we take more seriously than those things that come from the Tzavah of Rabbi Yehuda HaChosid. Okay, Zolzayim. So what does it say in Shulchan Aruch? It says in Shulchan Aruch that you have a goseis, so you're not allowed to cause him to die any earlier. However, says the Rambam at the end, that if, however, you have somebody who is banging outside, and that is prolonging the death of this person. There's a cold or fake, like a chotev eitzim. There's someone hacking holes outside. He's banging wood, or you have some salt on his tongue, and it's being ma'akev yitzias hanefesh. So in that case, you are allowed to remove it, because this is hasaras hamoneya. We're not allowed to hasten death, but we are allowed to remove something that is prolonging life. No? This is the big yesod of end-of-life issues, is what emerges from this Ramah. Now, for a goseis al kopanim, we are not allowed to prolong. For a goseis, what we can do is we can passively be meiser the moineya. We can remove the thing that is prolonging the life artificially. Now, obviously, this is very relevant, because today in our world, the end of life, you often have situations when a person is being artificially kept alive, no? That could happen through respirators, we'll talk about that separately, but that could happen through, very often, a person at the end of life can't eat normally, their swallowing reflexes goes away, and they are fed intravenously, no? Can you remove the intravenous feeding? Are you mechuyev to put a peg in to feed the person? The peg can often lead to aspiration. Are you mechuyev to do that or not? So the Ramah tells us that al kopanim by a goseis, you're allowed to passively remove something that is prolonging life. Now, nishalat hasha'ela, the Taz over here in Ois Beis raises a kasha. My dear Ramah, if I'm allowed to passively remove something, but I can't be active, and we said that by a geisis you can't touch the person even, so how can you remove the salt from the tongue? Right? The Taz in Sifkaten Beis raises the kasha, hasaras melach me'al lashono, you're moving the mouth. And the ha'ora, that should be usher. So therefore the Taz disagrees lahalacha, and the Taz says, you know what? You're not allowed to remove the salt from the tongue. The Beis Lechem Yehuda, on the bottom of the page of Shulchan Aruch, the Beis Lechem Yehuda suggests that maybe you're allowed to remove the salt because the salt was put there shelo kedin. The Ramah writes, or the Mechaber writes earlier, that you're not allowed to put salt on this person at the end because that is artificially prolonging his life. He can't do anything. So since they were noheg shelo kedin, they put the salt on, therefore, you can take the salt off. That's the Beis Lechem Yehuda's understanding of the Ramah. The Shach says that you are allowed to remove the salt from the tongue because the Shach in Nikudas HaKesef writes, Nianua kal kazeh lav klomu. This is just a tiny bit of movement. It's insignificant. It doesn't really matter. As I state in Shach. Now, halacha l'maisa, I think most poskim will, in the later Sfarim, the Derech HaChayim and the like, most poskim entirely reject the Shach. Most poskim feel that you're never allowed to touch a goseis. What about removing the salt? The answer is they follow the Taz, Ataka, you're not allowed to remove the salt. That's what the Mishmeres Smachos. We mentioned this is Rabbi Karp's Sefer on Avelos. The Mishmeres Machos Tainos that Halacha Lamaisa, most poskim, because in the Derech HaChayim. The Derech HaChayim is in the Sivis, no? In Europe, one of the major Sfarim, Halacha Lamaisa, that Rabbonim used was in the Sivis' Siddur, the Derech HaChayim. The Derech HaChayim Siddur, he writes that if it is a Moinea Meirachoik, then you're allowed to remove it. But any moneya mikarov you can't remove. Now, what about cases like this? Let's say I never had a brain death shaiva until a couple of months ago. Now, when I was in Eretz Yisrael, I mentioned that some of my community, Nebuch, had a terrible stroke. His wife had been nifter a few months before, and then he was Nifter himself. We changed his name when we were in when I was in Eretz Yisrael. Right? We spoke about the tshuva of the Nachla Shiva, about changing a name when you're far away. Right? We did all of that. But that was the first case I ever had of real brain death. And brain death is not a pashat thing at all. Brain death basically means, just like medically speaking, and we'll talk about everything now, right? Medically speaking, brain death means that there is no blood flow to the brain stem. The brain stem controls some of your automatic functions. For example, the brain stem controls your breathing. Now, you're still breathing in this case, but you're only breathing because there's a respirator, no? Because there's a machine that keeps you breathing. Lulay the machine, you would not be breathing. And brain death is an entirely modern invention. Because it used to be that when your brain stopped functioning, when the lower brain stem stopped functioning, so you would stop breathing right away and then you'd be dead. Lukuliyama, no? Because once you stop breathing, so then your heart's going to stop operating and then you'll be dead, no? Only in our world now can we have respirators that allow you to continue breathing even though your brain is not telling you to breathe. So the shaila is, well, my heart is beating, but I'm not really breathing on my own. What is the kaveya of death? Is death based on breathing, independent respiration, or is death based on cardiac function? No? And this is a whole shaila based on Gemara's in the Seches Yuma that we'll talk about in a few minutes, right? I shouldn't talk about it now, just because I didn't think about how I would present these ideas, so we'll talk about it now. But the Gemara in Yuma has a shaila. Let's say there's a case when Nafla Olav Macholas. So a building falls down and we die. So we can be Mechal Shabbos if there's someone who's still alive. If everyone is dead, obviously you can't be Mechal Shabbos. We have to check the people under the building collapse, whether they're alive or not. How do you check? Do you check by putting a feather near the nose to see if it moves? Or do you check by feeling the heart, whether the heart is beating? That sugya is the major sugya that everyone discusses in terms of the Hagdara of brain death. Because what that sugya is basically assuming is, well, where do you check the guy? Do you check him to the nose? That would mean that respiration, that breathing is death. Or do you check him not to the nose, you check him to the heart, because in that case, that means that the heartbeat is death. Now, of course, the sugya might not be determinative. Because that sugya in Yuma and Pehe, that sugya might be giving us a simen of Misa, but not the Hagdara of Misa, no? You see, over there, I might be checking because I want to know, is the guy alive or not? Not that the breathing is kaveya, not that the heart is even kaveya. And in fact, Rashi over there in Yuma Pehe says that the heart is only kaveya if you are not mazes aver. In other words, if you're moving, so then halachically you're alive. That's the impression that you get from Rashi, no? So it could be that the entire sugya is not determinative. And there are different girsos in that sugya. Unfortunately, this has become one of the dividing line issues between open orthodoxy and mainstream centrist modern orthodoxy, no? In open orthodoxy, they have come to accept brain death as the halachic definition of death. Without question. In mainstream, modern, centrist orthodoxy, they are less likely to accept that Haggadah. Now, there is a whole host of tshuvas that Reb Moshe Feinstein has, and the tshuvas associate each other, and it's not clear what Reb Moshe held. And there's some people who say that Reb Moshe really felt that brain death is death. And Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach had a famous sheep experiment that was done in front of him, that they decapitated the sheep, and they wanted to see, is the heart still beating, etc. And there was a whole discussion about brain death, and different poskim have different approaches to the brain death issue. But let's assume, like what I think the mainstream shita is among poskim, that brain death is either vadai not death or suffig if it's death. To assume that brain death is vadai death is more questionable, no? But I think the mainstream shita is that brain death is al kol panim a question. So in a situation when someone is brain dead, so then we assume you can't pull the plug. You can't take out the respirator. Because taking out the respirator would be killing the guy, no? It's only removing something. It is hasaras hamoneya. Well, hasaras hamoneya is not mutter if it is mikarev, if it's something that's close by. Hasaras hamoneya is mutter if it's merachek, if the guy is banging on the outside. So l'cha'ora, most assume, most in orthodoxy assume, this also has been an issue. The conservative movement long ago accepted the brain death criteria as death. But in orthodoxy, generally speaking, most assume that brain death is al kol panim a question. We'll talk about this in 1 minute after Mr. Buechler's question.
It sounds like the treatise is the salt. Salt is often in the car because you're touching the body, and the chopping the wood was somewhat external, so that seems miracle. Why would pulling a plug out of an outlet, let's say theoretically, be considered incarable?
Again, so it happens that the fingers right here operating on the guy. Right? The respirator is in the room with the chola. Practically speaking, it's right there.
So it wouldn't matter if you could push a button 500 miles.
So let's say I could push a button two blocks down with that. So I think the respirator is assumed to be mikarev because unlike the guy banging, there's no direct connection. Over here, there's a direct connection. The respirator is giving him oxygen right here. Right? So I think the respirator is assumed to be more mikarev. Moreover, there are a few other distinctions that we can develop as we go on. Mr. Press.
It's also so clear that the respirator or moving and pulling the plug is a hasaras hamoneya, because even though it's something external to the body and it is technically preventing from dying, it's still like replicating what the body is normally supposed to do on its own, so it's more
okay.
Kind of masking normal body function, in which case it would be like kind of granted an artificial one, but like removing a normal bodily function.
Right, so again, so it's an artificial normal bodily function, so that might be worse. I'll give you a mashal like this. You know, on Yontif, Yontif is coming up. So on Yontif, the post can discuss, am I allowed to turn off the gas? Now, to light the gas, we assume is mutter, because havar is mutter tzarech l'chol nefesh. What about to turn off the gas? So, Ashkenazim or Mekel, that to be mechabel tzarech l'chol nefesh is also permitted, but it has to be done in some grumma sort of way. So what we do, it says in Shulchan Aruch, is you take a pot of water and it boils over and then it puts the gas out. Right? That's what it says in Shulchan Aruch. Kibui, right, in the grumma way. Now, is it considered grumma if I just turn off the gas? In theory, when I turn off the gas, I have gas coming through a pipe. And I turn it off and I block the pipe. So it'll go off like a teeny bit after I turn the thing. Now, there's going to be a teeny bit of residual gas in the burners. So it lasts like an extra half a second. Reb Moshe Feinstein is Mekel. In the Tshuvas, he says something to the effect of, I have this cooler that I don't want to tell you what it is. Reb Moshe is Mekel that you're allowed to turn off the gas on Yontif. Most poskim feel that no. That that's considered direct action. No? It's not a grumma. That's a direct action. Right? Ashkenazim in general, or even Sfaradim, poskim today don't allow you to turn off electricity on Yontif. Even though, right, we have some physicists over here, the way electricity works is that you have the electrons that are going towards your light, assuming that it's a simple circuit, no? Physicist, right? I have a simple circuit, I have a battery, and the light bulb at the other end, right? So what happens? The electrons are flowing through and through and through and around, and it keeps that light bulb going. If I flip the switch and I turn it off, so effectively what I'm doing is I'm preventing the electrons from flowing to my light bulb. One could argue that should be some sort of grumma. I'm not directly, right, impacting on the light bulb, but generally speaking, we assume that's considered direct action. If it's considered direct action, so then it's harder to permit it, right, in the end-of-life situation. Now, Reb Moshe Feinstein does permit turning off the gas, Rav Moshe did not permit turning off electricity on Yom Tov, no? That's the question. What's the difference? I don't know. Moshe did permit turning off the gas, but that's generally not accepted. If it's not accepted, so then that means that we're considering a direct action, and then in the end-of-life situation, to stop the respirator, I'm stopping the oxygen. The oxygen is outside in a tank, no? And it comes through a tube, and then I'm blocking that tube. So that's assumed to be direct action of killing the guy. It's Mashal Mahadavadome. If I would take a pillow and put it over your mouth and nose and squeeze, right? That would be killing you. That's a Gemara in Sanhedrin, right? That is killing you. If I prevent the flow of oxygen into you, I am killing you. Nachon? So here also, L'cha'ora, I should be chayiv. Okay. Again, our approach is, assuming that we don't pass on like the Rambam about Hasaras HaMelach, is easier to understand that Merachok is permitted, Mikarov isn't. And we could define Merachok and Mikarov in the sense of whether it's in direct connection to that person. So now, a few questions regarding end of life. The big chakira in this is, do I allow cessation of treatment or withdrawal of treatment by someone who's not a goses? Now, you're going to say, Rabbi Schwartz, you have not yet defined what a goses is. And I'll tell you, you're right. And we have to define that. But naniach that I know what a goses is. Can I permit withdrawal of treatment with someone who's not a goses? No? Let's say you have somebody who, Rahman al-Atzlan, has difficulty, and the person, his kidneys or her kidneys stop functioning, so you have to go for dialysis to live, no? Am I allowed to decide not to go for dialysis? Am I allowed, let's say, I have... there are various conditions that you can't breathe, and you have to walk around with like an oxygen tank. Am I allowed to just remove that oxygen tank from a person? So most assume that we don't permit you to just end. That this is a special kula with a goses. That's what many, I don't know many, that's what, I don't know most, many assume that these kulas are formulated only by a goses. Now, one thing that I do see is that the shmua out there that you have to fight for every second of life is halachically not correct. The Ramah over here does permit hasaras hamoneya, al kopan and by a goses. Goses is kechay l'chol devarav. No? But nonetheless, we do permit hasaras hamoneya. The kraina de igrisa, that's a letter of the stipler. It's Ois Kuf Tzadi in the Kraina de Igrisa, right? So the stapler writes that people say the Shemua that you have to fight for every second of life. Lamais, that's not true. The Ran in the Dorim that we spoke about indicates that's not true as well. The fact that we could at times daven for someone to die indicates that, you know, as valuable as every second Ba'olam Hazeh is, but sometimes we are not going to push for every second of life. So what can you do? Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach in the Tshuva Siman Tzadi Aleph of Chelek Aleph, Reb Shlomo Zalman writes that at the end of life, what we could do is as follows. If someone is just going to be Mishutak, Mishutak means that the person is going to be paralyzed, even though it is very difficult to live life when you're completely paralyzed, and the quality of life is certainly compromised, says Rav Shlomo Zalman, you're not mechuyev to actively do surgery. That would be what we call heroic measures. That's not mechuyev. But you have to keep the guy alive, even though life is paralyzed. Life is not good. However, when you're a goses, so many people feel that just like you're Mechal HaShavas V'chay Yeshua, we'd be Mechal HaShavas to keep you alive, even for 1 minute. But still, Reb Shlomo Zalman says, you're not Mechuyev to what's it called? By your goyses, you could do the remor, which means passively, hasar samaneh is going to be permitted. If the person is suffering, if the person has machovim v'yisurim gedolim, or even sevel nefesh chazak ma'od, even if psychologically the person is in a very difficult place, but, says Rav Shlomo Zalman, you can't take away normal functions. Meaning, okay, a guy at the end of life, when the guy is at the goses stage, so what you can do is, says Rav Shlomo Zalman, food and oxygen, you have to give them even neged ritzono. Now, most poskim assume that what this means is you have to give the amount of oxygen that a normal person uses. There are different concentrations of oxygen, no? The standard air that we take in is, I don't know, basic nisht, what percentage? Right?
Yeah.
But you can basically give oxygen. This is the way Rabbi Lulig understands Rav Shlomo Zalman. I think this is very reasonable. You have to give the normal amount of food, of nutrition, that a person needs, and the normal amount of oxygen that a person needs. However, you don't have to give medications that causes the person pain, providing that the person doesn't want it. If the person decides, I want to prolong my life, okay. Right? Sometimes you have young people who, Rahman al-Tzalan, have cancer. So if it's a young person, we tend to be more active, no? We'll do more because this person could have 50 more years if it goes well. So we'll be more active. You have a person who's elderly and they have cancer. So the treatments are going to be painful. So the person has a right to say, I don't want the treatments. That, I think, is the standard approach of poskim. Now, Rabbi Willig, I had a case. This fellow, what happened was he had a very serious head injury, a stroke. And he's in the hospital. At first, they did a surgery to try to remove the blood from the brain. And they couldn't get it out, really. There was too much blood. They didn't know if he was brain dead or not. The way brain death is diagnosed is bedside diagnosis, which means you... Brain death, by the way, began the Harvard University 1968 study about brain death was something to the effect of they wanted to determine what's death. It's not clear. It's relevant religiously. It's relevant philosophically. It's relevant on many things. And Harvard put together this whole group to define what death is. And they came up that if you have what is called the irreversible cessation of, let me read the nusach, irreversible cessation of spontaneous respiration. That is the definition of death. Now, this means a few things. It has to be irreversible, meaning sometimes you can have a person who overdoses on some drugs, no? Do not do this, okay? If you try to do this and you say that my Rebbe said it, I will sue you for lying. But if you overdose on cocaine, no? It is entirely possible that you can have something that mimics death. No? You're going to stop breathing for a while. But it's not irreversible. Because they can give you these drugs, right? Narcan, whatever they are, and they can put you back. Gevaldik. It's not irreversible. If it's irreversible, cessation of spontaneous respiration. Spontaneous means that you're doing it on your own, not from the machine. That means when you're really brain dead, you are halachic. You are, according to the Harvard criteria of 1968, you are dead. That's their thing. Now, in order to diagnose brain death, they do bedside diagnosis. They shoot some air into your ears. They shoot a light into your eyes. They see, is there anything? And then they do what they call the apnea test, which is they take you off of the respirator and they see, do you have any breathing on your own? Sometimes a patient can be so weak that they won't do the apnea test. But the doctors are saying, we know this guy is brain dead. Now, what do I do in that case? In that case, I'm convinced that even if the halacha would assume that brain death is death, which itself is questionable, But you have to really appropriately diagnose the guy, just the hashara of the doctors, that we assume that if they take him off the machine, he wouldn't be breathing. Mehepatesi, that does anything, no? Now, what you could do, if the patient would be strong enough and the doctor would be willing to take them off the machine to test, you could take him off the machine for the apnea test, and then you don't have to put him back on the machine after. No? Because you're not mechuyev to apply something new. But, right, it's not at all pashut that in a situation when they have not diagnosed brain death that we can assume the guy is brain dead. Yaakov, you had a comment?
Yes. It's an irreversible cessation of breathing.
Spontaneous respiration.
Spontaneous respiration, right? That's essentially building into the definition.
No, so it's taking one sad in the Chakira from the Gemara in Yuma, and it's assuming it, but even if that's correct. Now, let me just add 2 points. The big daya that people assume, the chief rabbi of Israel years ago came out with a paper arguing that brain death is death. The reason to assume brain death is death is that this allows organ transplantation, no? If I want to give up a heart, I can't take the heart from, you're walking down the street, I can't say, excuse me, come over, here, chop out your heart, right? Like, I think in Indiana Jones, there. Right? You guys know what I'm talking about? Right? So in Indiana Jones, they at least took out the heart and it's still beating. That doesn't happen in the real world, Jeppo, say. I ran out of the theater when I was like 9 years old. Right. I was scared to death at that scene. Correct. Nachum. It's a really scary scene, but it happens. It doesn't happen, actually. It doesn't happen. You take out the heart, it's not going to breathe. The only way you can transplant a heart is because you assume that someone is a heart-beating cadaver. The nusa heart-beating cadaver is assuming that there is something called brain death. Right? You're a cadaver. You're dead. Why are you dead? Because there's irreversible cessation of spontaneous respiration. Because you're only breathing because of that machine. Well, you're still alive enough I could get that organ from you. So the state of Israel, the chief rabbinate said, brain death is death, based largely on the tshuva of Reb Moshe, that they assume that Reb Moshe held that brain death is death. Now, it's not so clear in Reb Moshe. There is one volume of translated tshuvas of Igros Moshe by Rabbi Tenler arguing that brain death is death. It's not at all pashut. Dr. Eddie Reifman, a few years ago in Tradition, published that the nusach of Reb Moshe in the tshuva really sounds like that the brain has begun to atrophy. Meaning that when there is no blood flow to the brain stem, the brain begins to disintegrate, no? If there'd be no blood flow to your finger bone begins to disintegrate, no? So Dr. Reichman published that it could be that even Reb Moshe assumes that brain death is death, but that's only when it begins to atrophy. Short of that, not. Moreover, there is some scientific question about brain death, especially in younger people. The Atlantic Monthly, around 2 months ago or 3 months ago, had a case. I'm sure someone's going to find it and send it to the WhatsApp group. But the Atlantic had an article about this young woman. She was like 10 years old, and she was diagnosed as brain death, and the family decided that they didn't want to give up on her, and they had to move her from wherever she was in the move America to New Jersey, because New Jersey has, because of the Haredim in New Jersey, New Jersey is one of the few states that does not accept the brain death criteria completely and allows you to buy out of it. They moved her to New Jersey, and she's brain dead. And all signs are that she's brain dead, but there seemed to be certain stuff going on. She got her first period, to connect to. She got her first period while she's officially brain dead. Now, how the heck could that happen? Right? If you're brain dead and the body is supposedly, there's no, brain death means that because the brain stem isn't operating, so there's no integration between your body parts. Now, the brain, like, usually you need a quarterback, right, to control everything. And if the quarterback ain't there, right? It's not going to work. Right? You can't play football without a quarterback. So without that brainstem, my whole body isn't integrated. So how on earth can I menstruate? It's a good kasha, no? Now, everyone knows, Dr. Shabtai has a book about brain death. Dr. Shabtai was here in the Kol HaElyon when he wrote this book. And there are serious questions on the approach of brain death. The questions, both halachically, because who says that Gemara in Yuma is determinative in the sense of who says that's the siba of death? Maybe it's just a simen. Moreover, we just don't really know that brain death means that there's a complete lack of integration. And the case of this young woman is a pircha on the entire brain death thing. So let's assume, I think like most poskim say, that brain death is not death. There was three shitos here in our yeshiva regarding brain death. Rabbi Tendler accepted what he felt Reb Moshe says, that brain death is halachically death. End of conversation. Now, Rabbi Tendler understood brain death to be the equivalent halachically of physical decapitation. His main raya is from a Mishnah in Ahalos that speaks about someone who is miguyad. Miguyad means that they chopped off your head. No? So the halacha assumes that you're dead. No, not happy. They chop off your head, you are dead. Right? But, right, if you have physiological decapitation, says Reb Moshe, as understood by Rabbi Tendler, you're also dead. Great, so no blood flow to the head, you are dead. That's Rabbi Tendler's approach. Rabbi Bleich says brain death is definitely not death. The Gemara in Yuma is a simen, not a siva. Rav Schechter feels that brain death is suffic death. No? Rav Schechter has the approach as follows. This is found in B'ikvei Atzon, page Resh Mem Vav in particular, that there are three Evarim Shanashama Tzuliya Behem. There is the brain, there is the heart, and there is the liver. No? Those are the three Evarim Shanashama Tzuliya Behem. Rav Schechter proves from a Tshuva and Reb Moshe that if there's no blood flow to any Evar, that Evar is dead. Right? Let's say you have somebody whose arm is paralyzed. You can still wear tefillin on the arm. But if your arm is gangrenous, if there's no blood flow at all to the arm, you can't wear tefillin on the arm. It's ki'ilo, the arm has come off. No? So, let's assume that the head came off. But I still have a suffix with Evarim Shanashama Tzuliya Behem, says Rav Schechter, that maybe you need all the Evarim to be dead. So therefore, says Rav Schechter, you know what? I don't know whether brain death is death or not. But one thing I know is that once you're brain dead, you are a gosis. Because gesisa means that the taha lechamisa has begun. Once you're a gosis, right? Now again, in the Nishmas Avram, they quote from Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach that when Dr. Abraham asked him, how do you define a gosis, he says, a taha rofe. Right? Do I have to translate that for you? Ihr bist dem Doktor. Yeah. So therefore, I don't know. And many posts can say, we don't know exactly what Gesisa is. Look in Tshuvas Vanogas, Chilak Vav, Simon Reish Lamed Vav. But, Rav Schechter says, I know what Gesisa is. When the process of death began, when one of the three Evam Shanashama Tzul Yibahem dies, then you're brain dead. But, you're still suffering alive. But once you're a gosis, so then for sure I can withdraw treatment. No? Now, Rabbi Willig, in the case of this fellow, who the doctors felt was gosis, the doctors felt was brain dead, but they didn't confirm it. Rabbi Willig said that withdrawing of treatment meant, even, that you could not give him the next bag of intravenous fluid. Right? Whenever you're on intravenous, they're going to add new bags once you use up that bag. Rabbi Willig felt that that's considered withdrawing treatment. What I told the family was, I still think this was correct, that it's better to follow Reb Shlomo Zalman, hydration would be the equivalent of food, to give normal levels of oxygen. But you can't not refill the bag. It happens that the guy passed away a day or two later. What we did, though, is we said that we're not going to give antibiotics for other conditions, no? We're not going to give antibiotics. We'll give routine treatment. Routine hydration. Routine oxygen. But we would not give. So when the guy began to develop an infection because he had fallen down and he was near the radiator after his stroke, and his arm was burned, and the burn led to a serious infection over there. So we didn't treat that infection. Eventually, he began to die. I actually didn't give shir that day. I was supposed to give a contemporary halacha that day. I got a call from the family that his blood pressure is dropping. I ran over to the hospital, and we said the vidui. We did all the things b'shas yitzias neshama, all the things that says in the svarim to do, and he was nifter. I told a kohen at that time. It was a kohen who wanted to come. I said, "You can't come. The guy's a gozes already." Once the doctor said that he's brain dead, the first shach over here quotes it later on in the Mishnah Ayin that a kohen is not allowed to enter the ohel of a gozes. So you can't come anymore. He's a gozes. They quote that b'shas yitzias neshama of Rav Kook, you just tell me them around. And at one point he turns to the nazir, who was a kohen, no? And he says, "You have to leave. I'm becoming a gozes now. Get out." Unbelievable. Right? Rav Kook had a present. Rav Kook was Kadosh Vitar. What? Rav Tzvi Yehuda could stay because it's his son. The child is allowed to be mitame to, right, to Aviv. Who, right? Yeah. So the story. So withdrawal of treatment, I think most poskim feel, like Rav Shlomo Zalman, that you still give the normal things, normal food, normal oxygen, but you don't have to do stuff out of the ordinary. In terms of brain death, it's not at all pashut what the din is. Rav Schechter feels that brain death is a suffix. Rabbi Tendler feels that brain death is definitely death. And Rabbi Blake feels that brain death is definitely alive. One year in the Purim Spiel here in Yeshiva, Rabbi Danny Rapp had the greatest chap ever, which is the one thing that Rabbi Schechter and Rabbi Tendler agree upon is whether a brain-dead person is allowed to eat tuna fish. Think about it. It's pashut. According to Rabbi Tendler, tuna fish is treif. According to Rabbi Schechter, tuna fish is kosher. But even according to Rabbi Tendler, the tuna fish is treif. If you're brain-dead, you're dead! Therefore, you can eat tuna fish! Right? This was ga'aynis, Rabbi ga'aynis, Rabbi Osai. This is like... Yeah, so again, the shitos over here are very interesting. Brain death is not such a common question. Lamaisa, it occupies much more space in the blogosphere, whatever. There's an institute out there called by Robbie Berman called HOLDS, Halachic Organ Donation Society. So the Dermos secret is HOLDS used to advertise in the Jewish Action magazine of the OU. Then, if you've noticed, in the last, 10 years, HOLDS has not advertised. The reason why they haven't advertised is at one point the RCA commissioned their halachic commission, which is chaired by Rabbi Usher Bush and Rav Daniel Feldman Shlita, to look into the brain death question. And they put out, a 100-page paper about brain death. Their paper basically says that Rav Moshe probably doesn't hold the brain death. And once Rav Moshe falls, Kemish Nafal Yisod Nafal Habinyin, and therefore the OU, which is connected to the RCA with some miraculous Kesher Shein Mishal Kayama, right, they had to withdraw the HOLDS ads. HOLDS is a complicated organization. Maybe we could talk about that a different time. Tevra, have a good day.
Thank you for going down.